Okay, well, it's time to get started. I know most of you, but for those of you who don't know me, I'm Bob Lee, and we'll be talking about forests and religion today, and the topic of clear cutting. And to give you a little bit of my personal history, a little bit of background on my own personal sense of theology about nature and why I have come up with that. And then we'll talk about clear cutting and some of the issues that surround that from a theological perspective, or at least a religious history perspective on part of it. So I have about 50 years of accumulated experience in forestry, whether it's education, field work, summer employment. I started out about 1958 in high school on trips to the National Forest and decided I was interested in forestry, and then went on to forestry school at the University of California at Berkeley, worked in the woods as a forester for several years, and then got caught up in the 60s and decided it was time to look at something about society and forests, and nobody was doing that at the time. So I ended up wandering around and ended up at Yale studying social philosophy and systems ecology, and got tired of talking to myself finally because no one else was doing that. And Yale hired a sociologist, so I spent the rest of my professional life combining sociology, systems ecology, anthropology. And out of all that work, I've come to the conclusion that we really can't understand our relationships of our society or any society to forests until we understand religion. And it's not just the established religions, but the spiritualist movements, New Age movements in the United States and other places in the world, which then help us understand how a society relates to the forest. And one of the big issues there that I've come up with over the years is that there's no theology to a lot of the emergent religion or spirituality. It's just effervescent, and it's constantly shifting. And that makes it very, very difficult for anyone who's a practicing forester or a policymaker to really understand what the public they're serving really is and how they think. And then after retiring last year, I decided, well, I'm just going to turn all my professional work upside down and start looking at it from a more formal religious perspective. So I'm self-educated in theology. I've been told that I've said I don't know much. I've been told that's not true, so I'll back off of that a little bit and say, yeah, I've been studying. Okay. Personal theology. I've handed out a little sheet of paper, and on there you will find a statement at the beginning, which is a preface to all my sessions here, which I found rather interesting in terms of its description. Did anybody get a copy of that piece of paper? If not, they're right down here in the chair. And the key thing there that I want to emphasize, and you'll see come really into full focus at the end of the session today, is that we can't live without taking from nature. We have to take life in order to live. And that's our big dilemma as humans. And we haven't figured out a way of framing that, of discussing it with one another, and accepting that even as a reality to ourselves. We deny that. So we live in a state of denial. That we do. To live, we have to take life. And maybe historically religions, particularly Native American religions, did a fairly good job of that. People gave thanks to the trees that they cut for canoes. They gave thanks to the deer for giving its life. We don't, in our culture, make that connection. And I'm not advocating Native American religion, just observing that other religions have made those connections and we haven't. So part of what I'll try to do today is end on a way we can make connections. And I've gotten inspired here a little bit because when this talk came together, I'm going to talk primarily about clear cuts from another perspective and sort of leave the development of an alternative perspective for a later time. And then the other night, Tuesday night, at the Vespers service, Don gave a very interesting homily about meeting Christ in the tailings, my tailings. And that inspired me to say, well, if Christ is in my tailings, then maybe Christ is in the clear cuts. So I thank Don for that. So I've retitled the talk. Call it, How to Eat a Clear Cut. Jesus, Monsters, and the Sacred. And so I've been caught up in this foolishness of God stuff, and I've come up with a foolish title. And I've gone back and reread 1 Corinthians 1, and yeah, it fits pretty well. It really works. Okay. So let's take a look at where we're going today, and then we'll dive into it. First of all, a little bit on my approach today and throughout the sessions here. It has to do with learning, how we learn. And the cognitive theory of learning that has developed in recent years about how the brain works. We will understand things and take in information if it fits the cognitive frame we have in our heads. There's a frame in our heads, and if information fits that, we accept it. Otherwise, we either reject it, don't understand it, it's confusing. And so we're talking about framing, the way we frame clear cuts. Here's a couple of examples. George Lakoff is a professor of linguistics at University of California, and he came up with an independent institute, the Rock Ridge Institute, that's been looking at framing. And of course, he's looking at the progressive, more liberal perspective, because framing has been so successful by the conservatives. And so he's taken on, for instance, one of the things there. How do you reframe taxation? To the conservative, taxation is tax relief. That's all that matters. You're a victim of an oppressive government that's taking your taxes, and you are suffering as a result. Lakoff says, let's turn that on its head. Taxation is a membership fee. You live in a society, you want schools, police, fire, roads. So you pay taxes. It's like being in a country club. You want to go to the country club and enjoy the bar, the pool, the tennis court, you pay your fees. And you can then argue about whether your fees are fair and whether you get your money's worth, but at least it's seen as a membership fee. So that's a way of reframing taxation. And we're going to look at clear cutting and how it's framed and how it could be reframed. And then something else that came out of cognitive science that I found very interesting, called source amnesia, which is we get information, it enters our brain, something new, it goes into a little compartment in our brain, I won't go into brain physiology, and then it diffuses out into the cortex in various places and it's stored. But the source is forgotten for most of us. And we remember the fact. We don't know where we learned it, but it's true. Something is good or bad because we learned it. As academics, we're forced into the situation of constantly keeping that linkage alive so we always know our sources. But as a sociologist, on the other half of my life, professionally, then the taken for granted things that we all accept in society and living together, the trust relationships, all that, really come alive because of that source amnesia. That's just the way it is in our society. We don't do those things. We do do them. So that's cognitive theory. We look at frames. We're going to look at two frames today. Chaotic destruction of nature as one frame, and the other frame will be looking at the unmasking of clear cuts through particularly looking at Paul and Walter Wink and the way in which we look at the power of human life and that way it affects nature. This all sounds really theoretical, but it's very practical. And why it's practical, I want to go into that here, and then we'll have some fun. It's practical because of politics and forest policy, and environmental policy in particular. Environmentalists have built their house on sand, and they built it out of cards. And the reason they've done this is they've used fear as the basis of motivating the public. We're gonna run out of oxygen if we cut too many trees. Kids are taught that in kindergarten. You won't be able to breathe if you cut the trees. I don't know how many kids I've encountered that I've had to say, wait a minute now. Let me give you a little lesson in biology. The world is going to come to an end. All these doomsday kinds of images have been used to motivate people to work for the environment. The problem with that is it's very easily trumped by bigger fears. And the George W. Bush administration understood this very clearly when they called up terrorism. And they trumped environmentalism and they put it down on the agenda, way down. And they could do it because they found a bigger fear. And that's a very unsound basis for any kind of environmental thinking and policy. And the environmental community really worked itself into a trap. Because those politicians who have other agendas can very easily turn that right on its head. So they have to be something else. So today, we're going to look at clear cuts, and let's start with just talking about clear cuts. And what I want to do as we start is just elicit from you what you think or feel when you see the words clear cut or clear cutting. I'm not going to give you an image because an image, you can read different things out of it. I want what happens when you have a word. The word creates the reality of the meaning. So I want the meaning that's associated with your feeling or with that word, because that word takes that perceived reality and gives it some substance. And so here, what is a clear cut to you? What's that feeling image in your mind?
Well, the blaring image for me right now is a couple weeks ago we had someone here talking about monarch butterflies, and they had an image of where the monarchs roost in Mexico. And right next to where the monarchs are going in the wintertime, there's clear cutting going on.
Right.
And you can just see it is nude. It is, there is nothing there. There is zero vegetation. And it is clear cut right up to where you see the orange of the monarchs. And it's destroying their habitat.
So it's nothing. It's destruction. Okay.
No trees.
No trees.
Injury. Ugly.
Pardon?
Ugly.
Ugly.
Dead orchard. Our neighbor clear cut the hill above us, and the water ran down and froze in the winter and killed all of our new young trees.
Oh boy. Oh. Dead orchard is right. That's very specific. Very specific meaning to you. Yeah. Okay. Any others?
Muddy streams. Stuff.
Pardon, Wendy?
Muddy streams.
Muddy streams.
And hot.
So they're all fairly, so far, fairly negative attributes, right?
Yeah. New trees growing.
Okay.
Like the jack pine that couldn't grow.
Right.
You can see the snow better in the mountains.
Get a different view
where the clear cuts are. That's the only positive I can think of, but I know you've got some up your sleeve.
Well,
oh, vistas.
Okay, vistas. Yeah, it's out in the west where we have lots of forest here, and particularly in Washington State, there's a conversion of forests to home sites, and people will build their house on, 20 acres they'll buy up in a clear-cut area with this big vista, and then all of a sudden all the trees grow up into their view, and they have some serious internal conflicts. Do we cut all those trees to get our view back or what? Anyway, it's fairly negative, and that's the common image. And we want to start with that and say, okay, what lies underneath that? What is the archetype, if you will? What's the underlying model? What structures, the frames, provides the boundaries to our thought on that? And that's where we'll take a look at a film here, if I can see where I put my paper. That was on. Oh, over here. we'll take a look at a film. And this is Fern Gully, and it's going to be two short segments. If anybody, how many people have seen Fern Gully, the children's cartoon? All right, it's sort of a child version of an eco-horror. And on the little handout there, you'll see there's a citation to a book on religion and monsters, in which they review eco-horror and the way in which popular culture has interpreted horror and used it for purposes of making religious interpretations and so forth. So, before we do that, I almost forget, I want to give you the Forester's view of a clear cut. Because a clear cut to a Forester is not just all this stuff, even though some of them may have those feelings about it. It's a prescribed method of regenerating the forest that involves felling all the trees and then either planting new trees or leaving a few trees that will seed in and start the new forest. And it started in Europe actually several centuries ago and was formalized in terms of professional methods. And early on, there were two primary reasons for it. One was that these were people who were agriculturalists, peasant farmers very often, and to graze their cows and to get wood from the forest and to get all the products of the forest, the detritus on the forest floor, the acorns and so forth, they had to mix these uses. And so they had to keep the cows and the other animals, the horses and the oxen and all, out of where the young trees were. So there was a segregation of types of use. It's pasture and open for a while, and then you had trees, and these things would rotate around. And so there was a very practical reason for it. And then foresters, or probably peasants and then foresters, discovered certain trees do not grow under the canopy of other trees. They require full sunlight. And if you think of trees, they require water, nutrients from the ground, sunlight, sun being one of the primary determinants. So, particularly out here in the Pacific Northwest region with the big Douglas fir forest, you see some Douglas fir here, but you cross the mountains, you get a lot of Douglas fir. Douglas fir will not grow under the canopy of other trees. It requires full light. Historically, what would happen is big fires would sweep through, or windstorms would blow down for us and would open up the area, and then the young forest would come along because it would kill all of the canopy of the old forest. So the regeneration of the forest, if you're cutting trees, requires very often that you open it up to where you have light, full light. So that's one of the other justifications professionally, and then the size of the harvest units had to be large enough to accommodate the light and to be efficient enough to allow economical harvesting. Well, over time, something I talked about yesterday, the economic view came to dominate in forestry. And so, particularly during the 1960s, 70s, and into the 80s, on national forests, it was more efficient to have larger and larger clear cuts. More revenue could be derived because the cost, the unit cost to set up a sale was less. So you get these larger and larger clear cuts, and that was really offensive to people. Silviculturally, in terms of the growing of trees, it was not necessary. It was economic. And that's still an issue. Clearing the forest for conversion to agriculture or for housing is not clear cutting. That's basically forest conversion. And that goes on massively around the United States. It's very important to understand that what happens in the Amazon, a lot of the clearing of the Amazon forest, is not clear cutting. Technically not clear cutting. It is the removal of forests for mining, for establishing agriculture, the removal of forests of the Great Lake regions during the development era of the West in the US was forest conversion. It was not clear cutting technically. But clear cutting is a very narrow technical definition within forestry. And that's the forester's framing of it. And I'm not going to try to educate you as foresters, but just.
Bob, run that by again about the Amazon, and you say it's not clear cutting?
Yeah, there are clear cuts in Brazil. Most of those clear cuts are where they're growing pine or eucalyptus on rapid, fast-growing rotations for pulp. The exploitation of the Amazon rainforests by clearing all the trees and then turning that over to farmers is not technically clear cutting from a forestry perspective. That's forest conversion. So cutting all the trees is not necessarily clear cutting. That could be just conversion of that land to something else.
Not in the forestry technical term, but in the popular imagination, yep. It's still called clear cutting.
And they're all lumped together in the popular imagination. And if you ask the students in my classes, they'd say it's all deforestation. Clear cutting is deforestation, even though it's not deforestation because a new crop of trees is coming along.
So technically, clear cutting is it's a forest management tool.
It's a forest management tool, and in the language of forestry, it's a silvicultural tool.
A what?
Silvicultural. So we have culturing trees, silva trees. So there are other ways of doing it where trees do not require as much light. You can take out a few trees. That's called selection. And selection harvesting will not work with Douglas fir and other trees that require full light for regeneration. There is a method called shelter wood, which is you take out about half the trees. You get some light down, and then the trees will seed into the forest floor, and then you come back a few years and take the rest of the trees out and leave the other ones to grow. So these are silvicultural options, and they're very different, but the public conflates it all. It's all either deforestation or seen as clear cutting, and then has these negative attributes. So what we want to do now is let's get hold of the public mind, if we can here, and see how the public frames this. So, to do that, I'm going to show you a little piece of Fern Gully, because this is what educates kids, popular culture. So, maybe your kids have learned about clear cutting by watching these images, and let me give you the story, and then I'll start it. The story of Fern Gully. There are these tree spirits, depicted as fairies, who live in the forest. It looks like an Amazon jungle forest. And a big, fat, ugly, greedy loggers come in with a great big machine into the forest. Well, in this forest, historically, these fairies, the tree spirits, got along very well with humans. And then this very destructive force somehow got loose and destroyed it all. Hexus got loose and destroyed it all. And then one of the queen fairies, the tree spirit, bound this monster up in a tree and was able to contain the evil. And then the loggers came in and they brought in with them this guy Zach, who was a naive, wet under the ears college kid who, without marking the trees, swatted a little bit, forestry wise, it's a little bit stupid because he's marking trees but they're cutting them all. So he's out with his paint can marking trees and he swats at an insect and marks this old gnarled tree in which Hexus has been embodied and is contained. Hexus gets loose, invades the harvesting machine, takes over the loggers, and starts for Fern Gully at full speed. And this is the sacred home of the tree spirits. And Zach wanders off in the woods as a college kid would, and is caught up with the fairies, reduced in size to fairy scale. And ultimately comes back, gets in the machine and turns it off, and Hexus, who you will see in the second segment, implodes, blows up, and the forest is resacralized and saved. That's the dominant theme of all eco-horrors, is technology comes in, whether it's atomic weapons or whatever, destroys something, great threat, and then the monster is contained or destroyed, and the sacred is reconstituted. Well, that's what this film is all about, and this is what your kids are learning. So let's see, a few segments.
The harmony of all.
But our closest friends were humans. Then, as sometimes happens, the balance of nature shifted. And Hexus, the very spirit of destruction, rose up from the bowels of the earth and rained down his poison. The forest was nearly destroyed. Many lives were lost, and the humans fled in fear, never to return. Most think they didn't survive. It was only by calling up the magical powers of nature that I was able to trap Hexus inside an enchanted tree and save Ferngully. Which is why it is so important for you to learn to use these powers. I won't be around forever, and you have to... Krista?
Okay. What does that say to us? Or what does that say to your children?
The trees protect us.
Trees protect us?
Well, and the fairies have seem to have a duty to protect the trees.
Tree spirits, they inhabit the trees and protect them.
And it's bad when trees get cut down.
Bad when trees get cut down.
And Hexus is really a volcano in the images. That is a natural process. Mm-hmm.
Natural process, and Hexus comes out of that volcano, and we'll see Hexus in the next segment. He's just beautiful. Any other things you want to comment on that first segment before we go on to the next? Yes.
Well, the one comment in there that they viewed humans as their closest friends,
right,
was interesting.
Yeah.
And then it disturbed the balance.
Disturbed the balance of nature. Okay, what kind of a theological statement is this? Is there a theology in this at all?
Only animism, yeah. Perhaps.
Animism?
Yeah.
You ready?
Hey, what would you do this?
We're going to go ahead and we're going to take a look at Hexus in a minute. Okay. Now.
I suck them dry.
Serpent, and sometimes like the blob, and sometimes like a skeleton, and
yeah. Yeah. Seems to embody petroleum.
Petroleum, oil. Yeah.
This is an oil spag.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how it it sort of conflates all of the ecological troubles as if they're one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Destroying the forest and petroleum sludge and diesel exhaust and
acid rain,
as if they're all the same thing.
Yeah. Demonic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this was made in what year?
It was 1992. And something else, I used this in class a few times, and something else some of my TAs pointed out one time that you will not see unless you want to borrow the film and look at it tonight, is that the loggers tend to have dark eyes and are darker skinned. The fairies are all lighter skinned. This is quite common in Disney films.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a racial coding that goes in as well in these messages, which I think is totally in it. Absolutely sure is inadvertent, but
yeah.
Part of the popular culture. So this is popular culture, and popular culture of forest destruction. So the image is the monster. And if I go to the roots of...
And the allies of the monster are fools.
Yeah.
Whose highest motivation is more overtime.
More overtime and money that stacks up to make these artificial trees.
Yeah.
So.
And now humans are the enemy.
And now humans, at least, but
yeah.
Zach is not, because Zach, he converts.
Okay.
And he falls in love. That's probably why he converts in it. He likes this little tree fairy. She's pretty cute. So,
I bet she's blonde and blue-eyed.
Oh, yeah. She
is.
It's all Hollywood. Anyway, so if I take and I look at popular culture and our framing of clear-cutting, the archetype is the monster that has disordered the landscape. And I keep going back to Job, the Leviathan, and then I say behemoth because there's the landed creature that's big, strong, that Job is reminded of. Look, I made all these things. They're ungoverned. So there's this question, there's something out there that's powerful and disturbing, and a chaos that's created by this, and that's very disturbing to us. So in that sense, clear cutting has called up that fear of chaos, fundamental existential chaos, a disordered world. And kids that would view this film, cutting the forests, some evil force has disordered it, destroyed it. Am I wrong on that reading of this? I mean, is there something else you see there? I'm looking
You've
at the
got to get them while they're young, because they're certainly not going to remember the source.
Thank you. You are a good teacher, Wendy.
Yeah. Just an observation is that I think one of the reasons we, especially in the Northwest, having grown up in the Northwest, you know, as a little kid in the 1950s being told that Oregon and Washington, and maybe Idaho and Montana, had, you know, virtually unlimited supplies of forests and lumber.
Right.
And that those were a big portion of our economy. But in a sense, we never had to see it. We never had to see,
right,
you know, the harvesting, at which, you know, is right, visually not great from an aesthetic standpoint, usually. And I think probably for a lot of us, at least emotionally, as adults, as we drive down the highway now, we can sit at our place in Cannon Beach and look up into the hills and see these huge, mm-hmm, not really bare, but
right,
by comparison, bare, clear-cut areas.
Yeah.
And
the blowdowns that happen after storms because, yeah, of that.
Because they've opened up the edge of a full forest.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it is disturbing our sense of what we were told as little kids was the norm.
Yeah. And it's because historically the first lands that were harvested were belonged to the industry. They were the lowlands, and then,
right,
after World War II and by 1965 and 70 began to do heavy cutting on the uplands.
Oh, yeah,
where the faces, like in Seattle, you look across, and in the last 25 years opened up a lot of clear cuts they'd never seen before.
Right.
Well, when I was teaching, I used to tell students, because the forestry school was right across the street from the medical school, that one of the problems that forestry faces is that when we make mistakes, our mistakes are out there for the whole world to look at. When the doctors across the street make the mistakes, they go and bury them in a hole somewhere. And there's a lot of truth in that we've made a lot of mistakes in forestry. And they're visible. And they're visible often for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And what we haven't, and I'll get to it at the end, is we don't have the discernment to see when we have done a good job and when we haven't, because the public reacts against rather than to see, oh, that was a bad job. That was a good job, as you would in medicine, mm-hmm, where you can get that discrimination, that discernment.
Bob, what are you calling mistakes in the
in forestry? Forest? For instance, you put a road in an area that should not have had a road, and you see a lot of this in the Cascades, and it had cut through a lot of clay soil. That clay soil loads up with water in the winter, and the whole hillside is swept down into the river, mm-hmm, and it leaves this great big scar, orange or whitish scar of the exposed rock and soil. Some of that happens naturally. You saw some of that coming up on the boat. Mm-hmm. Jenny and I were talking about some of it coming up on the boat on the lake here on the edges, which is totally a natural process. But improper roading can accelerate those natural processes and result in destruction of streams. So those are mistakes, and they're very visible.
Overuse of herbicides.
Overuse of herbicides, a whole variety of issues that come up. So what I'd like to do in the time remaining, if you see where the framing of clear cuts in the public mind, and particularly as we learn as little kids, is one that has really called up the monster. And not in those terms, except in this film, where it's just quite explicit. And that there are the good spirits, the tree spirits, kind of pantheism, that is in opposition to that. And that's the popular religion, the secular religion. So what's the alternative? Where do we go if we...
There's something about... as I was growing up in the Pacific Northwest, there was something about the unspoiled wilderness,
yep,
that was especially prized.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't, as a young kid, able to distinguish between unspoiled wilderness and a forest that had been replanted some 50 years or whatever before and was ready for harvest again, which is not unspoiled,
mm-hmm,
you know. Mm-hmm. But the unspoiled wilderness was something that was sort of sacred, in the popular imagination. And the idea of in clear cutting, you're spoiling the unspoiled wilderness. So I'd see a hillside with clear cut one place and not someplace else. And I didn't know that that was next and had already been replanted and regrown once. And and you know, just seeing the patchwork of where it was clear cut on the sides of the mountains was offensive to me, because I had this idea that the unspoiled wilderness is sacred.
Yeah. Yeah, and that dichotomy is something that's deeply embedded in popular culture. There's humans here, nature there, humans are destructive of nature, we need to limit the amount of destruction we do to the wild. And I've been searching, particularly this week, for a different way of framing these forestry issues. If in fact popular religion, secular religion, calls up monsters from pre-Christian times, that are not at all effective in terms of policy, because politicians can sometimes find bigger monsters and trump those old monsters. But what are some of those other frames? What could, how can we frame this?
Well, I think that's an extremely helpful way to think of it too. An example of a similar thing is when people, you know, before the worst of the evidence about tobacco came out, people would try to tell their kids, don't smoke, it'll stunt your growth. And as soon as kids figured out that wasn't true, they assumed that everything they were told about cigarettes was false.
Yep.
I remember being told all sorts of things about how awful marijuana was, some of which I now know is not true, and I wonder if those people were deliberately lying to me to keep me from doing that, or and how much more helpful would it have been to know the truth? You know, it's not as horrible as what we think. There is, and I think the environmental movement has lost a lot of credibility with exaggerated pictures of the horrors, when the truth ought to be good enough,
right,
to get us to be smarter about how we mm-hmm. manage the environment. Because the exaggerations only fuel the backlash and don't in the long run solve the problem.
Go ahead, Bob.
And just sort of building on that, I think it's not only the truth, but the acknowledgement where we don't know the truth. We're unclear, you know, what the right answers are, or what the science is behind some aspect of it, or whatever. Of course, you can take that to extremes, and I think of global warming is a good example of that, where the people who completely deny global warming, you know, continue to say we don't know, we don't know, we don't know.
Yeah.
And when in fact I think most of us would acknowledge that.
Right, and they latch on to every single trivial mistake in Al Gore's film to say, see, these people are lying to us.
Right.
That's why I found Al Gore's film to be a terrible problem, is that again, it's building on fear. Uh-huh. Rather than the facts as they may know them. Right.
Just musing a little bit and connecting it to the Bible study about Jonah and the whale. Right. Mm-hmm. The one construction that's not of stone is the ark. I mean, I have to presume, if it's a true story, that Noah cut some trees. The ark becomes the ark becomes a salvation.
That's great.
Sort of symbol. Much, you know, the whale had a pretty good role in that Jonah story. And the ark had a pretty good role.
It's interesting.
And so you've got a salvation story around trees.
Let me try out on you something that Dawn inspired in me the other day, and just see where it goes, is to try to say, okay, if we took Christian theology and reframed clear cuts, what might that look like?
and get your criticism of that. And see if it makes any sense. If it doesn't, I'll throw it out. But if I understand, and largely from Walter Wink, what the meaning of the crucifixion and the resurrection really happened, Jesus unmasked power. Took a hard look at power and said, here, look at this. This is humanity at work. And the powers of the world, powers and principalities and all that Wink talks about are many, and power, according to my readings, and I like a little essay on principalities and power out of Tillich, one of his sermons. But power is not good or bad, necessarily. It's how we use power. And one of our greatest powers is our power to dominate and control nature, destroy nature, or to use it creatively. So the question is, what does the cross, in that sense, mean for nature? How does, talking with Don's husband yesterday, Jack, about how Jesus mediates our relationship to nature. So let me make that a little bit more specific. And Don, if you have any criticisms, fire away. So Jesus unmasks the power. In this case, what is the power? The power is our domination of nature. And that power is a necessary power if we're to live, okay? We're going to have, if we want to live, we build the ark and survive. We have to cut some trees. They had to have some tools. They had to create some chaos out there. I bet they had a clear cut. Well, it wasn't a clear cut. It was probably some deforestation, because Noah wasn't worried about whether the trees were going to grow next. But he might have brought along some seeds so he could plant the trees after the end of the flood. And so it's an unmasking of the human power over nature. Because we cannot live without taking from life. So power, not good or evil. It can be creative or destructive. And then what this says is that when we look at a clear cut, we're looking at ourselves. A little bit like we're talking about today and the last several days in the Bible study on Jonah. Calls us to look at ourselves. Looking at a clear cut is to look at ourselves. And to be aware that we are connected to that clear cut. If we, in any way, inhabit a home, use paper, or any other of the hundreds of paper products or wood products that sustain our lives. So we are eating the clear cut.
Well, we may have power to clear cut it. There are so many things that we don't understand about how it works, as far as the rejuvenation and how it grows and all the intricacies of having that rise again.
Right, and because the public doesn't want to know. I mean, foresters would love to go out and say, here is what it's about, but people see it as destruction in their frame, because their frame is it's a chaotic act of creating chaos. It's bad. And they don't want to acknowledge, people don't want to acknowledge that they are the ultimate agents as consumers of this act.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is that there's a lot of relationships within the forest that, you know, we are discovering, but we still don't know them all.
Right.
And I think an awful lot of us are worried about having a final disruption where it can't
Right.
re-equalize itself.
Yeah, and so we want to back off and use the precautionary principle and say, mm-hmm. let's not harvest the forest. And the problem with that is, and this is one where we've dealt with this over the years in forestry, where people say, let's reserve our forests here until we know more about them. And there's some very sound, actually some very sound philosophy that backs that up. Informal philosophy. Don't take any action, respect the other, until you know the other, and then you can act sensitively with the other. It comes out of Manuel Levinas's work in France. But the problem with that is, then where do we get our wood? We go to Canada, Brazil, Indonesia, and I've been with ecologists on field tours who've said, that's just fine with me, it's not my forest there.
Wow.
See? And that's the issue, is that we are consumers, massive consumers in the world, and as long as we don't see it, it's okay, because that's part of our denial. And what the, if you impose the cross on the clear cut, what that does is say, yeah, we have put that clear cut in place, and now we have, putting the cross on it unmasks it as us, as our action. And then the question is, for foresters or for the public, was that creative? Was that excessively destructive? What is a good job of forestry or a bad job of forestry?
So so clear cutting, as I understand it, is one way of getting those wood products in a way that sort of mimics natural fiber.
In the Douglas fir region, you have to be very careful because it's always situational.
Right, but to the extent it does, it's therefore a less damaging way of getting forest products than the deforestation that's happening in Brazil.
Exactly.
And if you live in New England, Vermont and New Hampshire were almost denuded mm-hmm. at the end of the 19th century. And no replanting, nothing, they just came back when people yeah. let them grow.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is a little bit unique. Not all places do that. But
Foresters are so resilient. Trudy and I lived out on Kitsap Peninsula and carved a little home site out of a patch of forest, which I restored, and in part I restored. And if we went away for 15 years, came back, our house would be invisible. Mm-hmm. Before, it was almost pulling these seedlings out of the garden. And, I mean, it's amazing how resilient a forest is. And then to guide that through proper management, silvicultural practices, is to make sure that it doesn't take as long as it would under natural conditions to restore what was there. You know.
But not all places are that resilient. If you go to Southern Oregon you log a southern facing
Absolutely.
Hillside, trying to get trees to grow there again is really difficult because it gets so hot and the soil desiccates so badly in the summertime, they die.
Yeah.
They need those parent trees to get started again.
Exactly. And having started my forestry career in California, I've always wondered about that because in California, Douglas fir goes under a canopy mm-hmm. because it's hot. Now, why didn't they learn that in Southern Oregon? That's a mistake.
So is what you're saying about clear cut, to back up on what Susan said earlier about the law being, the function of the law is to show us who we are. So the function of the clear cut really is to show us who we are.
Right.
And at the same time function iconically as gospel, showing us where life comes from.
Yeah. And the forest, I mean, historically, what is it the passion that drew me into forestry? What is the passion of forestry? It's also to take chaos and to bring order to it. That's just to see a clear cut that's well regenerated and the trees are growing healthily on it is a real high for a forester.
Yeah, and see, that's what I, in my gut, react, because of my upbringing,
right.
react negatively to, because when you idealize or idolize the unspoiled wilderness, the order is the problem, and the chaos is good.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, and it's a question of whose order?
Right.
Nature's wild order or human order?
Right.
And
but that theologically, that's a problem because human beings are we're to be managers of this world that God has placed us in.
Yeah.
For good, not for ill, not to exploit it entirely for our own uses, but to manage it to benefit everybody.
Right.
So.
And the disconnect isn't just with forestry.
No, no.
How many of us slaughter our own chicken or whatever, or have any idea where our food really comes from?
Yeah. I had an interesting experience yesterday. I took a walk with the student who's here, who's already left, Dan Castillo. And we were talking about these issues because he's doing a master's thesis on it and he wanted to see what my thinking was. And he said, it's really interesting that, you know, in stewardship, really, God gave us the responsibility of being gardeners of the earth. If you read the second creation story in particular. And what he found really interesting is that who did Mary see when she went to the tomb?
The gardener.
The gardener. Huh. She mistook Jesus for the gardener. I'm really intrigued by that. Sitting with me all night.
I don't want to push my ark thing too far, but the promise also came from a tree when the dove brought
the branch
back.
Yep. And when it was on a wooden cross.
So what does it mean if the cross then mediates, or Jesus mediates our relationship to the Lord of clear cuts? Well, clearly, in the summary here, I'll just summarize, we can get on to lunch. Eating clear cuts is in no way, in my thinking, a sacramental act. Okay, some people get into this whole thing of, you know, forests and sacrament and nature and, you know, sacramental interpretations of wild, and I'm not going there at all. That's not what I'm far more classical in that sense. What we are doing is swallowing truth. Mm-hmm. When we eat a clear cut. And that truth is uncomfortable and it goes down real hard. If we get it down, sometimes we vomit. Most of the time we vomit it up and say, I don't, you know, what was that? I don't know what it was that we're trying to get down. And just, in that sense, just as taxes can be reframed as membership, then clear cuts can be reframed as unmasking.
Why we have trouble swallowing this sometimes is we have a vision that earlier cultures, whether it be Native American or people who came before, had this wonderful relationship with nature that didn't disturb anything, and they only took what they needed, and they had this sacramental relationship with it. And you know, they denuded and had to move on. They used all the resources in an area, then they moved on. But there were few enough people that by the time they got back to that spot, it had rejuvenated. And I think we do those folks a disfavor and ourselves in thinking that somehow we can live in this world and never change anything.
Yep. Yep. Well, that's really a good point. So what does this mean to forestry? A little bit about what it means to theology, I think. Well, you know, foresters have a challenge. Forestry has become dominated by economics. And historically, in the mid part of the 20th century, and then dominated by an appreciation for the wild and the new ethic, which is highly fluid and not governed by a theology, so it's hard to get hold of. It's very slippery, and yet it maps a lot of the popular mind. But at some point, we're going to have to reinvent forestry so that we can have a discriminating public that can discern, you know, what is good forestry and what is not good forestry. And I like, and I've always wanted to do and never done, is to do a study of how legible forests are. And by that I mean, and I should have brought some slides with me, except I didn't think I was going to do this when I was at home, that if you have a hillside and you have several different ages of forest on it, as you do in the Black Forest of Germany and other places I've traveled, you can see the process. The landscape tells you. There's a small clear cut, some little trees, bigger trees over here, middle-sized trees, you know, fairly tall trees, and mature trees. And the whole process is communicated by the landscape. You have a legible landscape.
There's some of that going on. I think I've seen it on the Olympic Peninsula. I'm not sure where else it is, where next to a stand of trees, they'll have a sign that said when it was harvested, when it was replanted, when it was thinned, when it'll be ready for harvest again.
Yeah, that's a step toward it. The problem is you often have a 100-acre clear cut. If any of you have come, if you're from Washington State, come from Hopium and Aberdeen, and you're coming toward Olympia, and you come to the hills there before you get to Olympia, and the Capitol Forest, which is one of the state forests, you'll see different ages laid out right before you. And that communicates, that's legible, that communicates process. So I don't know what the doorway is to where we can really eat clear cuts, swallow that, but I think it has a lot to do with a discipline, a theological discipline, and how that gets popularized, I don't know. But clearly, foresters, theologians, the religious community, and others have a role to play. That's about all I have to say today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.